lot of years, I believed that the quality of my work would get me what I deserved. But I don't politic, and I don't change with the times, and it turns out that that shit's more important than good, honest work. So yesterday, after we stop a massive amount of drugs from getting into the school system, we get suspended because it wasn't done politely.
What are we doing here?
We're monitoring a suspicious individual to try and figure out if he's got any money he doesn't need.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Dragged Across Concrete.
This is a bad idea. It's bad for you, and it's bad for me. It's bad like lasagna in a can.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Sean Ray.
Are you certain of this response? You appear to be uncertain.
No, I'm quite certain.
Hosted by Arnie.
He looks like a snorer.
Stuart.
Your productivity is exemplary.
And Jacob.
He looks cast iron.
He is.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Okay, you gotta be careful around these parts.
Listener discretion is advised.
Start the party.
Shotgun Safari! Shotgun Safari!
Today we're being Dragged Across Concrete. Starring Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn, Tori Kittles, Michael J. White, Jennifer Carpenter, Lori Holden, Fred Melamed, Udo Kier, Thomas Kretschmann, and Don Johnson, directed by S. Craig Zahler. Hey, shitheads, listen up. This is Arnie, co-host of Now Playing, and Stuart.
And this is the co-host who sounds like a dolphin, Jacob.
Thank you, patrons. Thanks for coming. We've covered the Oscars a few weeks ago. I watched the Spirit Awards. What the hell is this movie? The most underseen film of 2019 actually has a Razzie nomination to it.
What?
They created a new category. This movie is lumped in it. Most extravagant destruction of public property and human life. Dragged Across Concrete, which with a name like that, it should be no surprise. If I come to a movie like that and it looks like Care Bears, they've done something wrong. I want to see extravagant destruction.
I would be shocked. I've seen all the films of Craig Zahler. Like, none of them are feel-good films. They're all extremely violent. Like, this is not out of the norm. So I guess give him a Lifetime Achievement Razzie for that category?
Yeah, let's start with this. Why are we doing this movie? We didn't pick it. It was chosen for us by longtime patron Sean Ray.
Yeah. He says that he really likes this filmmaker. This is his third film, Bone Tomahawk and Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Yeah, I've seen them all.
Sean Ray says, Zahler makes no apologies. He just makes the films he wants to, and Sean respects that. It's not everyone's type of film, but he really digs him. And he's a big Mel Gibson fan as an actor, director, but he doesn't hear people talk about this movie. And so he'd want to hear us discuss it. And I'll admit, I hadn't heard of this movie. This is kind of there with Locke and Coherence as a patron pick that I might have scrolled past it on TiVo one day or on Netflix, but I did not have this movie in my consciousness.
I got it confused. I actually thought it was Get the Gringo we were watching. Like, I knew Mel Gibson had made a movie where he's shooting people.
We talked about that during Rambo.
Yeah, I was like, some Mel Gibson movie, but not being a fan, I wasn't eager for a comeback for him. But yes, once I realized and connected it with S. Craig Zahler, that's somebody that's really on the move. I think he's really a new, exciting voice in film that's happening right now.
Yeah, I've seen all his films. I've never set out to see them all. Like, it all kind of happened by accident. Then afterwards, I look up the director. I'm like, oh, it's this guy who did this movie. Like, Bone Tomahawk came out same year as Hateful Eight by Tarantino. It's a Western. It stars Kurt Russell. Like, people, like, were arguing which one's the better film. Bone Tomahawk's a Western horror film, really. I mean, Sid Haig shows up for a cameo, so you know it's going to have at least one scary moment.
That film I have heard of, yeah.
I saw that one as well. He apparently came at that. It's a strange trajectory. He came out as a cinematographer a decade before and shot films of no particular note and then started writing Western novels. Who does that? And then became a hit.
I did not know that.
Yeah, but what happened was Cormac McCarthy was kind of happening. If you know him, he wrote No Country for Old Men. He has a whole saga about the Old West, Blood Meridian, very bloody and twisted. Not your father's Western, you know? Like, they definitely have a twist to them. And Ridley Scott directed the film The Counselor. That was written by Cormac McCarthy. He was looking for the next movie like that. And he picked up one of Zahler's novels, Wraith of the Broken Land, and said, oh, this is awesome. We need to do this. And in fact, some people in Hollywood will tell you the reason why The Revenant happened and Hateful Eight happened was because of this novelist, that people saw this and everyone was eager to get this kind of vision up on the screen. That's what his Western novels are like, Revenant, Hateful Eight, and Bone Tomahawk, yes.
In Bone Tomahawk, I'll say it's impressive for a film that doesn't have much of a budget. Like, I feel like throw him a few more million dollars and it could be a better film. Like, he does what he can, but it's, I want to see the next thing. Like, okay, that's an impressive first step. Then I went to his second film. I didn't know I was watching a Zoller film again. Brawl in Cell Block 99, starring Vince Vaughn. It's a prison film and recommended to me because my very suburban, very Christian sister saw it thinking, oh, Vince Vaughn, he does funny stuff. And watched this very violent prison exploitation film and like found it hilarious that Vince Vaughn, like, it is kind of funny, like the way he plays the character. But that one like confused me. I'm like, okay, is this supposed to be like tongue in cheek playing off of exploitation? Is it supposed to be serious exploit? Like, what is he going for here?
That's the one that disappointed me. I actually saw it and I was kind of like, I don't know. It's very brutal, which is impressive. It's also very stupid, which may be intentional. I feel like it's bloated and silly, and that might be exactly what you're looking for on a certain night of the week. Like, it probably takes just right if you're in the mood for it. It's a prison assassination movie with Don Johnson as the evil warden and Vince Vaughn as a man who intentionally throws himself in the worst ring of the worst prison because he's got to save his wife and unborn child. It's very silly.
Yeah, and that's how I kind of felt afterwards. I'm like, what do I do with this film? But then 2019, Drag Across Concrete, Sean Ray says no one was talking about this. I saw this film because people were talking about it. There was controversy. I think part of it, I don't know a whole lot about Zoller, but I've read that he is libertarian, so some people projected those politics onto the film. Like, look, we're going to talk about this film. There are some tough politics, some tough attitudes that are in this film, and I don't think Zoller is going to comment a whole lot on whether they're right or wrong or what to do with them. It's just, here's some very bad people doing something. And so I felt like there was controversy, and that's how it came across my radar, and I saw it not knowing it was Zoller, and then I'm like, oh, this is Zoller. I think I get what he's doing now. Like, he is kind of like Tarantino, where he loves exploitation films, like a horror western and a prison film, and then this one that we're going to discuss. But he doesn't go the route of Tarantino, where it's funny and light, and it's kind of like a good jazz tune, and you're just enjoying your way through this three-hour film. It's like, no, let's do exploitation, but make it very grim and realistic and dark and not fun.
Yeah, his horror bona fides even go beyond that. I don't know if you know it or not. I haven't seen this one, but he wrote the last Puppet Master movie too, The Littlest Reich.
Oh, I remember reading that. I have not seen it.
I have heard really good things about that one, legitimately. I mean, reviews were positive. I think Barbara Gordon's in it from Reanimator and from Beyond. And I've just seen a lot of Twitter chatter about it saying it's actually good, which I find hard to believe.
Yeah, I think Zoller is a good writer. I mean, I went and actually found one of his novels and read him, and I actually feel like that's the strongest stuff. You're right about Bone Tomahawk. It was good, but it could have been so much better if they had more money. Like, your heart breaks sometimes when you see the frontier town. But yeah, what a great concept to be like a cannibal tribe against a posse of Kurt Russell and Patrick Wilson and David Arquette and Matthew Fox. Like, it was very compelling, and it has a vivisection I will never, ever, ever forget. But he also, another horror thing he did, I subscribed to Shudder. I don't know if you guys know this.
Yeah, I subscribe.
It's a streaming platform for horror content. They really got excited. They had his first audio state experience, which, if you don't know what that is, and I certainly didn't, it's a ear movie, also known, by the way, as a radio play.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Okay.
And in that, they actually have Kurt Russell's kid, Wyatt Russell. He's doing one of the voices. It's kind of a metaphor about falling in love. He meets a girl and then some Lovecraftian monsters and weird people are also popping up. I won't spoil it. It's called The Nero Caves. It was a fun listen, maybe a little bit long at 3 hours, but I do think that this man definitely knows how to tell a story, and I'm enjoying watching him learn how to direct and make films. I still feel like what holds him back is that he hasn't mastered the visuals, maybe doesn't have the budget yet, doesn't have all the command of and the craft of filming. But coming into this movie, I hadn't seen it. My hope was, having seen everything else, that this would be the one to prove that Craig Zahler is also a director as well as a writer. But, you know, again, Mel Gibson, that's a tough one. Is he forgiven in the age of Trump? In the age of outrage, where so many people can get away with saying so much crazy shit, do we care about sugar tits anymore? I feel like his comeback already started a few years ago. Hacksaw Ridge was up for an Oscar. People really like it. It was okay.
I don't want to tell people how to feel about him. This is a situation. Can I separate the art from the artist? Especially in this film, because I think he's going to play up to that image that a lot of people have of him as a racist. Like, that is kind of the whole conceit of this film. And so, bravo, I guess, for owning that. I don't know. It's complicated, but I feel like I could separate his art from him at this point.
That's where I'm at, too. I will never like the man the way I did before all of that stuff came out, but I'm able to put it out of my mind. I watched Daddy's Home 2. I didn't like it, but I watched it.
You should be more upset at him for that than anything he said on the phone to his girlfriend.
Yeah, there's no way that could end up well, right? I mean, here's the thing. I watched the behind-the-scenes features. There's not a whole lot, maybe about 50 minutes. But a lot of Mel and a lot of his co-stars, and I'm wondering, are they going to say it? Obviously, there are similarities between this dirty cop who does his good job, but also has these troubling ideas. Is anyone going to say it's really important that we get Mel Gibson for this because he embodies so much of what this character does?
Yeah, was that intentional?
Nobody says shit. He's a great director. He really knows what's going on. It remains subtext, but I think important subtext. I don't think, having watched this movie, anybody else could play this part as well as Mel Gibson. This is the perfect movie for Mel Gibson to make in 2018, 2019.
Yeah, it takes on a whole different meaning knowing, you know, having that meta knowledge of what Gibson has done and then playing this role, seeing what he's doing. Like, I do feel like it adds something to this. And that's why I was pretty impressed with it when I first saw it, because, yeah, you're really going there. You're going for something in this film.
Seeing Mel Gibson in this wasn't a shock. Seeing Vince Vaughn in this kind of took me off guard because it made me realize, I haven't seen Vince Vaughn in years. What has Vince Vaughn been doing?
Come on, you didn't watch The Internship?
That's the last movie I saw him in. That was 7 years ago.
It's also not very good.
Well, here's the thing. I don't think I've ever seen much of Vince Vaughn. I realize that Swingers, Lost World, and then he was on the ill-fated second season of True Detective. I mean, True Detective first season, everybody loved. And he tried to do what he does in Brawl and in this movie. He tried to be the gangster guy, and it just fell flat. So it was not encouraging to know that he was going to try it again with Mel Gibson. It's a cool cast for some people. Again, I'm hanging on to the fact that I really like this writer and hoping he's going to prove that he's a director. But let's talk about what he's written. Let's talk about this movie. Let's find out what happens when you get dragged across concrete. Arnie?
In Dragged Across Concrete, Mel Gibson plays Detective Brett Ridgman, a cop who's getting too old for this shit. Worm finally turned on that one. Ridgman barely makes ends meet, his wife suffers from multiple sclerosis, and his daughter is harassed in their rough neighborhood. So when Ridgman is suspended for police brutality, he decides to rob some criminals to give his family a better life. He contacts his partner, Anthony Lorisetti, played by Vince Vaughn, and convinces him to help. They use their detective skills to stake out the residence of known criminal Lorenz Vogelman, played by Thomas Kretschmann. But the two cops uncover more than the simple drug deal or some other small crime they were expecting. Vogelman is a cold-hearted killer who's tired of robbing convenience stores and decides to rob a bank of some gold bullion. To assist with this, he hires two local criminals, Henry Johns, a recent parolee played by Tori Kittles, and his friend Biscuit, played by Michael J. White. The two young men quickly realize their involvement with Vogelman may get them both killed. The crooked cops tail Vogelman to the bank, where he kills several people, takes one woman hostage, and drives away with the gold. They follow Vogelman's van to a remote area and watch from a distance, not knowing what the hell's going on, when Biscuit and Henry try to make a run for it and shoot at their employer and his murderous goons. Biscuit is killed, but Henry remains hidden. Ridgman and Lorisetti try to take down the van, but it's heavily armored. Vogelman releases his hostage, who crawls over to the two cops, but she was hiding a gun and shoots and kills Lorisetti before being shot in the head by Ridgman. Ridgeman kills Vogelman and his goons, but he's taken off guard by Henry, who recorded Ridgeman's killing spree on his cell phone. The two agree to split the gold 60-40, with Henry taking the larger cut. They go to dispose of the bodies, but Ridgeman pulls a gun on Henry, demanding the cell phone video be deleted. Henry pulls a hidden gun and kills Ridgeman, but promises Ridgeman's wife and daughter will be well taken care of. And the movie ends 11 months later, and we see Henry lives in a huge mansion and plays video games with his young brother, while Ridgeman's wife gets a mysterious package with some gold in it, as credits roll.
Now, Zoller always gets compared to Tarantino. I think it's obvious. We can see all the ways that influences have happened.
Oh my God, this felt like a flashback to the 90s. I'm like, am I watching another Killing Zoe? This felt so much like all those crime noir Tarantino wannabe films from that era.
But one thing that Zoller does that goes beyond Tarantino, that innovates, is Tarantino loves his soundtracks. He'll go and he'll find the perfect OJ song to put in his movie. The amazing thing about this film is we'll get those OJ songs, but they're written by Zoller. Zoller actually sat down with the Old Soul group and said, "We're going to do new material. I want you to sing Street Corner Felines as we kick off this movie," which I just love.
I had no idea. I thought he just found some old soul funk stuff to play like Tarantino would have.
No, it's part of his process. He says, "I'm a writer. I don't like to use music to tell characters. I want the actors to do it. But when we need music, I'm going to write it. It's a part of my writing process to add to it." And so he was just lucky enough to be able to get to Tavares and OJ's as well.
And I didn't know he was a writer, but I feel that throughout this film. And just this meticulous attention to detail. Like, this film is almost 3 hours. And again, I think you could cut a lot of it, but you lose that flavor of what are the mechanics behind these actions and those actions. Like, not stuff you necessarily need, but they're interesting. And I feel like, yeah, a writer, that would fit in a novel. And the fact that he's so meticulous he's gonna write lyrics for his own movie. Well, there you go. I'm shocked, but also kind of not shocked, because I do see how deep he goes with really laying things out in this film.
And yet it took me about a half an hour to notice in this film there's no score. He may be writing music, but he's only writing those pop songs, and they'll repeat to have something to play over the credits. But you say he wants the actors to sell the mood. He's not going to assist them. You know, the director's job is to make sure the actors sell their mood. He's putting it all on the actors. He's like, "I'm not going to do anything to help sell the mood of this scene." There is not a note of score in this whole film. And it leads to some interesting audio design.
I think that is a theme throughout that. He's not going to tell you how to feel about any of these characters that are doing awful things. Like, some of them are going to be rewarded for doing awful things. The fact that he's not going to have musical cues to tell you how to feel about something. I just feel like, yeah, that fits this film. He is not going to tell you a whole lot besides present a lot of ugly people.
Yeah, he spent 10 minutes monologuing about moral ambiguity on the behind-the-scenes stuff. He really, like, I actually appreciate his candor. He says, "I'm not an important filmmaker. I don't look at this as saying, oh my God, I make the best stuff, but I want it to be good, and I want it to be morally ambiguous." And it's frustrating that more directors aren't willing to trust the audience to create characters that they may not like. I intentionally designed four people that you may not like at all, but you're going to be compelled to see their story unfold. Two sets. We have first, in the beginning of this, Biscuit and Henry Johns, lifelong friends. Henry is just getting out of prison, and Biscuit is treating him to a hooker that was in his elementary class. They used to have third grade together, and now they're hooking up.
You know, not a hooker, but a stripper. I had a similar experience.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
So I understand that.
Yes, it's a completion issue. Finally had that done. Lifelong.
But what's interesting to me is I thought Henry was going to be the focus of this film. It starts with him. We see him here with the hooker. We see him with Biscuit, who's an actor I'm more familiar with. I don't know Tori Kittles. I do know Michael J. White.
Apparently he was Spawn. I feel like I haven't seen anything that he's done, but people would know him if they watch action movies, I guess.
And then he goes home to his house, you know, priorities. First hooker, then mom and brother.
Mm-hmm.
But with all of this, I feel like I'm seeing what the movie's going to be about. We're going to be following this guy's acclimation back in, and when Biscuit talks about a job, you know, this is how every crime film goes. Reminding me, you know, Ocean's 11 or something. You get out of prison, you get another job to continue your lifestyle. I thought this movie would revolve around Henry. He's going to fall to a B-level character.
And Arnie, I think that's kind of by design, because I thought the same thing when I first saw this. Oh, this is going to be a movie about Henry getting out of jail and getting that job. And, you know, his mom's doing heroin and hooking, and his brother wants to be a video game designer. This is going to be about him finding a way to take care of his family. And then he kind of drops out. To me, at least my interpretation is that it is by design, because this film is so much about race. And it's like, yeah, we're going to marginalize the black man. The guy who actually is kind of the hero of the film, he's going to be marginalized, downgraded to a B character. Character drop out for long segments of the film. And to me, yeah, I agree. You think he's going to be the star and then he drops out. I think it's by design.
I actually feel like he is the main character. He and Mel Gibson live parallel lives. They come from completely opposite ends of things, but they are going through exactly the same thing. One is a criminal, one is a cop, but both will fall on hard circumstance. They need to help their family that's in a bad situation, living in a bad environment, and so they agree to a job that will bring them together and eventually work together.
They're similar, and yet they're a bit different. And I think that this is a film about their differences. Like, again, at the beginning, we see Henry sit down with Ethan. They're playing a video game. I don't know if the Safari game is a real video game. It doesn't look real to me, but I don't play modern games, so maybe it is. But what are they doing? They're hunting lions. Later on, we're going to see Gibson with his wife and daughter. What are they doing? They're watching a movie about cubs, lion cubs, beaten, taken care of by the parents. Like, it does. One's hunting lions. One see themselves as the top of the jungle, as the lion. And like, that is going to morph throughout the film.
Yes, they should be. Again, here's one character that abuses power to put people like Henry away. And who knows, maybe he even did put Henry away. We don't know. We think of them as being enemies. And this movie will take a long time, but eventually make the point that they have more in common in their lives than differences. And maybe they can even hash it out when they stumble onto some gold that falls into their lap.
I saw the parallels, and no, Jacob, I never thought it was by accident that the character falls out. Obviously, there is a lot of control being done here. I have no question that Zoller is, as Sean Ray said, he's doing exactly what he wants to do, and so I don't think any of this is accidental. I think everything here is deliberate, but I do feel that when we jump 3 weeks after Henry gets out of jail and we're introduced to the two cops, Brett and Anthony, those are the characters we're going to really focus on for the rest of the film.
Well, two things about that. One, they're played by the biggest stars in the movie, so obviously we give them more weight and they're going to demand it. Their agents require it. But I also think that Henry drops out of the movie in the same way that John Travolta drops out of Pulp Fiction, and that it's such a surprise when you see him in the bathroom in the second segment. That's kind of what Henry does when he pops back into the story. He is seemingly a supporting character. There's actually a lot of characters that kind of bubble around in here. We're not sure what they're worth until we get to the middle of the movie. We think because Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn are here, they're cops. This is a buddy cop movie. We've got to believe that this is the story being told. It will be a surprise to realize, in my mind, Henry's more important than we might have thought.
But when we introduce to these two cops, I gotta ding the filmmaking, because it's quite obvious they're supposed to be out at night staking out to get a drug dealer. They put that stupid blue filter over. This is being shot in daylight.
Oh, I took it as early morning.
Yeah, it's morning. What are you talking about, night?
They got the soup showing up to fix some plumbing. I didn't take it as supposed to be night.
No, it's definitely the morning. They said the duffel bag that they were watching went in last night, so...
There is a whole conversation about, like, coffee. I guess if you're doing a stakeout at night, you still need coffee to stay up. But again, I associate that with the morning.
The look of this film, I like the composition of the scenes, but overall, I think that the use of lighting and color does not work for me.
It's the digital camera. It's the fact that we're not watching film. You watch a Tarantino movie shot on film. This looks like Red One, not even a top-of-the-line camera. I agree with you. This is what I'm talking about with more money. Zoller needs to have a Tarantino or Michael Mann budget in order to know if he is a really good director or whether he's just a B director because no one will give him an A-list price tag.
Yeah, it's just sometimes in this movie, I have trouble seeing what's going on, and I don't believe that's by design. I believe things get muddied in the dark.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. And again, they obviously shot this on the cheap on a digital camera that is not top of the line. And maybe that works for you. I mean, we're in a new era. People are watching more and more digitally shot movies. Maybe they like them more than I do and don't mind. But I'm glad to know that I'm not the only one that had this problem, Arnie.
Yeah, if I want to watch a YouTube video, I'll go to YouTube. If I want to watch a movie, I want it to look like a movie.
Well, I think that's a bit harsh. It's not quite the quality of YouTube. I don't know. I think watching it at home, I guess because I knew who this director was, even though I didn't know going in, but I just kind of accept it for what it is. That's always been my problem. Like, give him some more money. I think he could do something that looks even better with it. He's not going to waste it.
You're talking about how cheap it is. I honestly was thinking, are Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn dirt cheap actors? Are they a step away from, have you guys heard of that site Cameo? It's like going to a homeless shelter for former celebrities, where it's like, if you give us $50, we'll send you a 2-minute digital video thanking you. And it's, you know, all those people who used to be famous.
I do think some actors like a script and they know they're not going to get paid a whole lot, but they like the project. So they're willing to downgrade and not get paid as much. I don't know if it's just because they can't get work in Hollywood anymore.
Gibson is working, but most of the projects seem to be going straight to VOD. They're not theatrical endeavors. Again, he's a pariah. He said things and did things and offended people and audiences that make many people wonder, why do we need to bring him on? Particularly now that he's in his 50s, 60s here. He's not the young, handsome, sexiest man alive, Mel. All aging actors face that. Bruce Willis, Arnold Schwarzenegger, all the tough guys are seeing their careers geometrically shrink. Mel Gibson's no different. His is just smaller, I think, because of sugar tits.
Yeah, it was such a more simpler time when that was offensive.
I mean, he said a lot of anti-Semitic stuff. It wasn't just sugar tits.
Yes. Zoller has a big neck-stomping fetish. If you watch that brawl in Cell Block 99...
That's like the big scene in it, yeah.
Oh my God, there's just so much about stomping on people's neck and dragging them on concrete and every other surface. But here we get a little taste of that because Vasquez is trying to sneak out on the fire escape that they're waiting for him. They chain him up, put his neck down, and then go in to find out if Rosalinda is a friend or foe.
Call me crazy, but I didn't see anything so terrible here. I mean, I've seen some of these videos that get out on the news of police brutality caught on tape. I saw a cop body slam a 12-year-old at a junior high.
Arnie, but isn't that kind of the point of this film? Again, I don't think Zoller's saying if it's right or wrong, but okay, I don't want a cop stepping on my head. I would argue that's brutality, but in the grand scheme of what we've seen, is that like as awful as... No, that's pretty tame, but Gibson's character, Brett, his kind of grudge with society is that it's too politically correct, that even just stepping on a guy's head now is going to get you suspended for 6 weeks because of that Mexican-American inspector. Like, you know, if you want to see how certain people feel about society being too PC and snowflakes, yeah, downplay maybe the violence and see it still get blown up.
To be clear, I would never want to be arrested in this manner, and I think anyone would agree. As citizens, we should be asked more for our arresting officers if someone is not pointing a gun at them to be essentially tortured. I mean, they go the like leg, the arm, stepping on the neck. None of that had to be done in order to stop him from escaping. He had essentially forfeited and giving up. But I do think, yeah, when we finally get to the scene with Don Johnson, a lot of where we're at and how reactionary we are. I mean, it feels transient. Because it's going to air on the news, that's why it's a big deal. It's because everyone's going to pay attention for one moment and say, this is awful. Don't worry, they'll look away and everyone will forget. We know how this works, but for the next 6 months, you guys need to disappear.
6 weeks. But yeah. I find it hard to believe that any video of what they're doing there. I mean, yes, I don't want to have my neck stepped on even if I've broken the law. But it's not very visual. And did the cops who killed that guy for selling illegal cigarettes, did they even get a 6-week suspension? I mean, I know they didn't get found guilty. 6 weeks without pay for stepping on a guy's neck seems outside the realm of what the real world would do.
I mean, it sounds like you're siding with Gibson. I think that's part of the argument of this film. I don't condone police brutality. I agree, like, stepping on a guy's head is tame. Ironically, it's like even tamer than what they do to Rosalinda when they get inside, and none of that gets filmed. No one finds out about any of that. Like, they throw her in the shower naked and turn on the cold water and then make her stand there. I do feel like they're gonna steal that money and whatever she has hidden there at first, but like they lie to her. They're like, oh, just tell us where it is and we'll let you go, and they arrest, like,
I think it's only because they have that third guy that they don't do it. There's the guy posing as the plumber. If he wasn't there, they would have taken that money.
I'm not sure, because we're gonna find out that Vince Vaughn's character doesn't necessarily jump to the idea of robbing from criminals themselves. I'm glad that they have this scene with the woman, because it makes me feel like, yeah, you guys deserve to be punished 6 weeks without pay, not for what you were caught doing, but for what we saw you do that was not caught and put on television. If this was caught, yes, obviously suspension, firing, lawsuits, the whole nine, but it's just what happened on the fire escape. It wasn't cinematic. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. When I saw the cop body slam the 12-year-old, that's visual. People want to see that on the news and then be outraged.
Artie, you, and I mostly have too, have quit really using Twitter. You know how things blow up on social media. Like in 2019, when this film came out, I don't think it's that far of a stretch to think that this video would go viral and people would be up in arms.
A white police officer stepping on a Mexican man's neck who has been disarmed and not a threat to them is a reason for many people to speak out legitimately. And on social media, it would be magnified by 1,000.
But I will also say, in cases like Trayvon Martin, I could also see Mel Gibson celebrated as a white man for stepping on a Mexican's neck.
And I think that is part of the controversy of this film, is because you brought up the age of Trump, Stuart. I think if your politics lean a certain way, you are going to agree with Mel Gibson that it's all about being PC and I just want to do what works and gets things done and get drugs out of the schools. I don't have time to be PC. Like, that is a thing people say. I disagree with it, but that is a viewpoint, and this film is going to show that viewpoint and not comment on it. And I think that was part of the controversy that at least caught my attention and made me want to see this.
We don't normally see Hollywood movies where main characters take these positions. They're usually much more clean cut. And when I see something like that, it's Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men. He's the villain. You can't handle the truth. What I do to protect America may be unethical, but that's why you're safe. And you ought to thank me. And so when we get to Don Johnson, it feels very similar. When he's being branded a racist today is like being accused of a communist in the 50s. Be it a private phone call remark, again, you're just thinking about those answering machine messages, Mel Gibson left, or yes, how you treat a minority that, by the way, something we didn't know from the scene, he was selling drugs to children. Adding that information to it, does that cloud the morality of it? Can we understand and have more empathy for these men because of how awful this seemingly innocent victim was? But yes, I really like the fact that they call the news the entertainment industry formerly known as the news.
Yeah, they're not going to say fake news, but they get close.
The idea is that these people believe that they're the intolerant ones. The media, social media, the news reporters, they're the ones that don't know the score. And so we're going to spend time with that audience. And that's unusual for any Hollywood movie.
And Don Johnson's just got a little cameo here as the chief. But again, I like the conversation that's being had. I don't agree with everyone. I want to make that clear. But I like the conversation because it is muddy in real life. Things are complicated. And the fact that the chief is like, well, yeah, I play the politics. That's where I am. And you know what, Brett, you've spent too much time. He doesn't say dragged across concrete, but I think he says scuffing the concrete. And that takes your empathy away. That turns you into a different person. And yeah, maybe you need to get behind a desk and get a different perspective. So what's interesting about the chief is that he kind of agrees with Brett and kind of has what people might think are racist tendencies, but he also does have this view that, like, yeah, you do need to change your perspective and you might see things a little bit differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting scene. It's an interesting and topical way. We're running into the flame. And just to be clear, in case you're really uncomfortable about this, Zoller in the commentary segment said, I wanted audiences to hate these guys. I thought very early everyone is going to go, I don't like them. And that was my intent. He wanted Mel Gibson, the embodiment of someone who has done and said awful things, but also been persecuted for those things, publicly humiliated, to be that representation in 2019 and be faced without a way of protecting his family. What makes him similar to Henry is that they both love their family and will do whatever it takes, including committing crimes, in order to protect them. In this case, when we meet Melanie and his daughter Sarah, they live in a poor neighborhood where Sarah gets big gulps thrown on her, and Melanie can't work because she has multiple sclerosis. So all the pressure is for him to win the bread and find the money to move away. That can't be done.
Yeah, in the subtext, though, is like, we're poor, we should be better off because we're white. It's the black kids that are attacking their daughter. And again, it is not this overt racism. It's just a casual racism in their language. Like, it just reminds me of listening to my grandfather talk, because he, according to him, he was beat up by Mexican gangs in high school all the time, and that's why he hated Mexicans. But if you could sit down and like talk this through, maybe you could come to different conclusions that was a gang, and that's not all Mexicans, or not all these kids in the neighborhood are bad. It's just these few. Like, look, people want to be pure and say there's no room for any racism. I want to find a way for people with maybe not the best outlook on all races to have a way to come back and repent and make amends. That's why I think it's interesting seeing this depiction here, where, yeah, I could come up with my own judgments, but I don't feel like the film is going to tell you what to think. I think, again, there are certain people with political leanings that would totally be on Mill's side in this film.
Well, here's the problem, and here's where we're really at, is people know that they shouldn't hold these ideas, but if they live in an insular environment, the only black people that they deal with are the people that they're arresting, then how can it not reinforce racist notions? Suddenly that reality to them doesn't sync up with what they're being told and they're being vilified for. So that is the interesting dynamic. And I think anyone living in this day and age can feel that disconnect between what people on social media tell them they should be doing from what their day-to-day experience actually is. And so, yeah, I think it's really good that they're playing with fire. I really love the fact that Zoller has created two cops that are not easy to like, and then we're contrasting that with two criminals who are kind of lovable because, yeah, one's trying to save his drug-addicted mother and apparently went to jail for beating the guy that put his brother in a wheelchair. Like, there's nobility and there's troubling aspects to both characters, and we're going to see black and white come together by the end of the film. Much like Hateful Eight, I want to point out. That was a similar notion about the Abraham Lincoln letter and the racist and Sam Jackson all figuring out that they needed to kill the posse.
I'm not sure that black and white ever come together actually in this film, but
I mean, we'll discuss it.
Yeah, we'll talk about the climax. They definitely are working together in the final moments of the film. Does the movie deliver the climax that we deserve? Arguable. But I like the fact that, again, the world of Mel Gibson, even though he doesn't see it, looks very similar to me. With his daughter being bullied, it looks very similar to Henry's brother in a wheelchair because someone beat on him, and Mel Gibson's wife having to sit at home, unable to have a job, while Henry's mother has to turn tricks with some guy that, you know, she doesn't want to do that to pay for her drug addiction. There's comparisons that are really important here.
And I thought that was his wife at first, because he grabs a baseball bat and chases the guy out. I thought he was actually very restrained that his wife was sleeping with another guy. He's like, take that trash out.
Right. And Henry has a friend that's kind of underdeveloped.
Yeah, you're saying this is about two groups of people. I don't know. It's about Henry and then about Brett and Anthony. Like, I don't feel Biscuit really has a story here.
Well, I mean, I feel he has as much a story as Vince Vaughn. Maybe Vince Vaughn has a little bit
Vince
more.
Vince Vaughn has more. He's got a fiance and that whole journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like Vince Vaughn's character, Lorisetti, is actually, maybe he doesn't have any more money, but he's spending more money. He's probably in some incredible debt because he has a nicer car and he has no problem laying down the payment for the engagement ring. He's not worried about the suspension. He's worried that the woman that he's dating is not going to say yes when he shows her the ring. And he has reason to worry. Like, when they hang out at night, she's razzing him for beating up on minorities and getting suspended. Like, she doesn't seem to respect him.
I looked up this actress. I mean, again, talking about the quality of just the actual lighting and everything, it is very dark at times. I looked up the actor that plays his fiance. She's Canadian, but she does look like a person of color, which would definitely, you know, oh, you're suspended because you beat up a Mexican? Like, that would definitely have some implications, I think, if you're in this kind of relationship.
Yes, she definitely seems to have second thoughts, and he seems to be gung-ho about marrying her, but is he punching above his weight? And will she say yes when she sees this very nice ring that he gets from a mall jewelry store?
You know, in watching it, I didn't believe she wouldn't say yes because it's a movie and because he bought this big diamond. I kind of feel like you don't buy that diamond unless you're pretty sure. So despite his own hesitation, I thought it was kind of a sure thing. So this movie did fool me.
That's kind of Anthony's trait, though. He's never sure. Like, I'm in until I'm out.
Yes. And, you know, this feels a lot, you know, we've covered recently, Bad Boys, Lethal Weapon, Rush Hour. We know this formula, and in many ways, Dragged Across Concrete emulates those films, but it's interesting when it doesn't. It is until it isn't, is Vince Vaughn saying in this film. That's also true of this movie's commitment to being a buddy cop movie. It's like, it is until it isn't, until the stakeouts go too long, and some of the bickering isn't funny, it's just kind of nasty. And yeah, you just feel like it's a harsher world and we're not permitted to laugh as much or in the same way as we would in any other buddy team up.
This never feels like a buddy cop film to me because those are fun. This feels like a crime film that just happens to have a pair of cops.
But Shane Black can be this nasty, but he always likes to keep it. Again, the bad behavior that we're seeing, we're judging Mel and Vince for doing it. In a Shane Black movie, you're not asked to judge.
And I think just by casting Mel Gibson, who was in Lethal Weapon, by getting Vince Vaughn, who I think is more known for comedy, reason why my very innocent sister watched Brawl in Cell Block 99. I don't know how you think comedy with that title, but she did. But yeah, I think you're supposed to kind of go to that buddy cop type of film. But yeah, this is the dark, grim reality version of it.
Yeah, it's an interesting contrast to something we know very well. It feels in some ways very much like any of those, but then it won't do what we expect it to do. And we may feel frustrated. I don't know. Technically speaking, this movie looks different. The pacing is longer, more like a Tarantino. There's just more despair here. I think it would be a real hard sell to tell someone that loves Lethal Weapon or Rush Hour that this is a movie for them.
No, but what I'm getting reminded of more is kind of like The Sopranos or something. Yes, these are bad cops who are kicked off the force and they're going to try to steal some money to get their families going. But they're not robbing from banks themselves. They want to rob criminals. I think these are cops that could be anti-heroes that you could kind of roll with in a post-Sopranos world where you can root for bad people and still empathize with them. If they were going and robbing a jewelry store themselves or something, it would be less forgivable. But they want to steal money from bad people, and instead of putting it in an evidence locker, putting it in their pocket. That tells me there's people that you can still side with and root for in this film.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the film, that is Anthony, Vince Vaughn's character's whole thing is like, people aren't going to get hurt, right? That's going to become a big deal when the bank robbery goes down. Like, what should have they done in that moment? Like, that is something they're always discussing because, yeah, they do see themselves, right or wrong, different than the common criminal, even though they're doing criminal stuff.
Yeah, I think Mel Gibson has more to lose because he's older. He mentions the fact that he's just a few months away from being 60 years old and life has passed him by and he's not going to leave any legacy for a teenage daughter that clearly could use the money to get to a better place. And so he's willing to take that risk and doesn't necessarily expect his partner to come with him. He gives him plenty of opportunity to say, this is my deal. Do you want to come along? He's the one that goes and sees Udukir at the $5,000 suit shop in the mall and gets the tip about the baddie of the movie, Lawrence Vogelman.
All right. The suit shop really shined a light on something for me, though. The movie definitely feels Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking a shit ton about food, which is like a Tarantino thing. But you know what it's lacking is the Tarantino grasp of how people actually talk. He's in the suit shop and there's a clerk there and speaking about nothing in particular, he's like, how much that cost? $5,000. Is it bulletproof? I mean, it just doesn't have the naturalism.
You think Tarantino's natural?
Yeah, that's blowing my mind.
I don't feel he's natural.
I don't believe people rob coffee shops and quote like Fonzie. I mean, that's no, I don't think it's natural.
No, I think it by quoting Fonzie, people constantly bring up television shows and things. I'm just saying, when you see Jules and Vince in the car having the conversation about Royale with cheese, you feel like that's a real conversation that could happen among a couple of friends or coworkers, whereas the suit shop banter, it's awkward.
I will give you this, Arnie. Yeah, I do, even though I don't think Tarantino's dialogue is natural, like it's all ramped up to 11, I think as a director, he's able to get performances from his actors that make it feel cool and make it flow and maybe make it feel natural. Zoller, maybe he doesn't have quite that talent, and that maybe that's the difference here, because I feel like both Tarantino and Zoller, like, they like to write. Like, I get that just from watching their films. They like to write long, long, detailed stories and dialogue. One's probably a better director. I'm going to go on out on a limb and say Tarantino's probably better than Zoller here.
Yeah, the actors all said when they got the script, it read literally like a novel. They're like, there's just, you don't normally put so much description in a screenplay format. It's a very bare bones. It's meant to be a skeleton, and it's the director's job to fill in all those details. The screenwriters basically just keep it moving is the directive there. But yes, in his scripts, there's just detail, there's lingering, and yeah, there's an aspiration to find character detail and motivation in slow, meditative, quasi-funny things. I think maybe because I love Udo Kier, I kind of just love this Frederick bit. What you're learning is, here's a guy whose son is doing very well. He can sell $5,000 suits. He has none of the problems, even though he is a fellow white guy, he has none of the problems of Mel Gibson. And so Mel is having to get this tip and trying to, you know, the guy's telling him, I don't even really know tips anymore. If he did, he wouldn't have sent them on a mission to stop a bank robbery. They would have never wanted to steal money from a bank. They don't want to profit from that. They want a heroin dealer that is selling drugs and stealing that money feels more or less clean. But yeah, if they had known, if this guy had given the right tip and said, yeah, they're about to rob a bank, they probably would have just called that in.
And there was a scene earlier before Brett sees Udo Kier's character, which again, I think it's telling that why does he go to him? Because Brett, not doing maybe the cop thing, even though he says he's not going to be PC, he's just going to do the right thing. He let Udo Kier's son go for a future favor. And that's the only reason he's given them this tip. But earlier in the film, there's this scene in a convenience store where like an armed guy in a mask comes in and just shoots the cashier and takes the money and then shoots a customer and then just shoots up the chips. Like, we got to feel like this is going to a bad place, right?
Oh my God, no, the opposite. When that scene comes, one of the things Zoller gets off on that I dislike is dropping us in the middle of something totally different with characters we've never seen before, like we're channel flipping. And it's like I channel flipped off of this dirty cop drama, and now I'm into some comedic gas station robbery where maybe I'm taking this too literally, but ammunition is expensive. And if you have that level of hardware, you're tactical. I understand he comes in, he's giving exact time. You have 30 seconds to give me your drawer or you're dead. He's being very specific. Somebody comes in behind, it interrupts the plan. He shoots that guy, turns around, the clerk had gotten a shotgun, shoots the clerk. I get all this. It's tactical, it's smart. Then he's going to shoot the television and shoot bags of chips and leave shells everywhere. Now I think this guy's a fucking moron in a Looney Tunes commercial.
Yeah, that's the point. That's the character. That's why it's different than another thing. Here's a character that, look at what he got off the register. It could have been more than $12. There was nothing in that register. He killed those people not because, wow, this is going to be an amazing score. It's because I want to shoot up things. And that's all I really want to do. It's telling you who they're referred to in the credits as black gloves and gray gloves. I didn't realize until later they're cousins. It's mentioned by Henry and Biscuit that they're going to work for two cousins. And they're the henchmen of this Vogelman that Mel Gibson is learning about.
I mean, Vogelman is a heroin dealer. Are they getting money to buy this van? That kind of is how it plays out. But like, yeah, $12 at a time at convenience stores, it's going to take a while.
Yeah, there's also two other guys that feel like they were eating Royale with cheese.
Yes.
And then came to the car, and the other guy pops out of the back, makes them put up the windscreen so that we can't, we know something's going to splat inside that car, and puts the sombrero on the Mexican guy after he shoots him. Is it as good as Tarantino? No, but it feels like that flavor. I'll tell you who it's better than. And this movie is also reminding me a lot of, because it makes these moves, Heat.
Yes.
This feels like a Michael Mann movie, but it has a whole lot more flavor, and the plot hangs together a whole lot better. It's not just about being capital C cool.
And yet, I think Michael Mann's visual style and score and music give that film a flow that this can't. And you don't have every character there dirty. You may think Pacino neglects his family a little bit, but Pacino isn't out there trying to rob people, you know? And you root a little bit for De Niro as a criminal. Now that you've said it, I knew there was something at the edge of my mind. And yeah.
I mean, when they put on those hockey masks, you're not thinking of Heat?
Yeah, the whole thing at the center is based on this robbery that goes bad. I mean, whether Zoller intentionally or not does it, it is Heat in the sense that we have a criminal and a cop that are going to find out they're more similar than dissimilar by having this bank robbery in the center that's extravagant and goes wrong. And mixed throughout it are all these other extraneous storylines, which come together better than Heat. I just want to point out that was a red arrow for me because they had stupid things like the serial killer and some of that stuff. You talk about dropping in the middle of character stories. That was a movie that was very guilty of doing it and not doing it well.
I don't think this movie does it well. Here in the beginning, and by the beginning, I mean the first hour of a 2 hour and 40 minute film, I'm pretty forgiving because we're still getting introduced to characters. We're still getting our bearings, even though normally you have that all done in the first half hour of a film. But he's going to keep doing it for much of the movie for reasons that I understand what he's trying to do, but I believe it is interfering with good flow of story.
I disagree. I strongly disagree with that. It's a mystery to try and figure out how are all these people related. And the fun is you're leaning in and listening to every line of dialogue, which is well written. It may not be funny the way Tarantino dialogue is, but is nuanced. Almost everything that they're talking about will tell you aspects about the character that I don't see give consideration in like a mainstream buddy cop movie.
Yeah, there's a scene earlier on again with Henry and Biscuit where Henry's got the like cellophane wrapped guns. Yeah, they're going to get used at the end, but the whole point is no prints. That's telling you Henry's smart. He's thinking ahead. You know, it's setting up the character more than an action piece at the end because ultimately his prints are probably all over the place. He was driving that van, but it's what it tells you that he thought ahead of time to wrap those guns in cellophane. Like, there are just lots of little details. Yeah, this is a long film, but I kind of like how it meanders and gets deep into the details of certain things.
We have discussed many times about films that require you to be an active participant and pay attention and listen to details, and it rewards you for that. I think this film likes to think it's one of those, but I found the attention I paid to it not rewarding because it's like a gag. Here's a character who, how is this going to be related? Oh, just tangentially, just they're going to appear in one more scene and then they're gone.
But how is that different from Pulp Fiction? I mean, there's a lot of characters that are talking about French in bed that like really they don't do anything, or maybe they do a lot because you've created this whole storyline in your head based on scant evidence. I mean, I think it has the lived-in quality where you could spend as much time as you want to thinking about the characters. I think it's interesting you don't want to spend time thinking about the characters. You don't like them.
It's not that I don't like them. It's that I don't like his method of delivering details about the characters, primarily editing and style choices. I think 40 minutes needs to be cut out of this film, and I could name specific scenes.
Oh, there's definitely scenes that you could cut that you would still be able to understand this film fine. I agree with you. I like what the scenes add, though. I like this world he's created.
Yeah, and Pulp Fiction is a very indulgent film. It's not one of my favorite Tarantino films. I take a lot of heat for that. It reminds me of that kind of Tarantino. The difference is Tarantino puts chapter headings in it. He'll tell you when a segment is over. He tells tell you when he's turning the page. Here, it is much more of a reach in the box and pull out and see what you get. It does take an extraordinary amount of time to realize that these two assassins are collecting loose change to pay for a super cool van that they're going to use to rob a bank for the heroin dealer, Lawrence Vogelman, who Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn are sitting outside his apartment.
The apartment that doesn't exist.
Right, exactly. Having some kind of stakeout shenanigans.
Yeah, and to recall that podcast, Pulp Fiction's also not my favorite. But with chapter headings, Tarantino's also playing with expectations by playing with time. This is very linear. There's no jumping around in the timeline. There's no flashbacks, flash forwards. There's flash sideways. You know, here's what's going on with other people, some of whom we've never met. The scene that pisses me off, the scene that gives this movie a red arrow, because I was on the line. There's a scene before the bank robbery where we're introduced to this woman who we've never seen before. We're going to spend 5 minutes with her outside the door wanting to see her baby. Who's the guy inside? Somebody we know? No, somebody we're never going to see again. What's the deal? Why is the baby behind the locked door? Why won't she go to work?
Now stop. You do know why. They're telling you a whole lot about this person. She has postpartum depression. This is the first baby back at work after 3 months. She doesn't really like her job. She doesn't want to leave her baby. Her husband knows that she's so crazy about it. He's chain locked the door because he knows she's going to skip out on the bus. This is all good, good character work.
For a character that's completely irrelevant.
You could say that about every character. It's irrelevant if you don't care about the story being told. This is an anthology. This is a movie where many different stories are being told, Pulp Fiction style, weaved together in a way that I feel is actually well-crafted.
I'm really, really dumbfounded by the fact of it's a waste if you don't care about the character. That is inviting chaotic storytelling in every medium to just have characters wander in and out with absolutely no discipline and no threads, and you're like, but I like the character.
There is a thread. The theme is family. Everyone here is struggling with how to deal with work in relation to how it allows them to take care of the people that they love in a job that doesn't appreciate them. Here's another woman dealing with the same thing that Mel Gibson is dealing with.
I will say this, Arnie, I'm going to give you some empathy here. I think this movie is about how we need more empathy towards each other and to listen and understand. I will say this, the first time I saw this film, this whole character, you see her, you spend all this time with her, and then she dies in the next scene. I was like, what the fuck? Did I miss something? Was she introduced earlier? Like, why did this happen? Like, I feel like because this is a long film and it's going to meander and just zigzag all over the place. Like, there are these moments that pull me back in. And that was one of them. Like, I'm like, okay, wait, I got to reevaluate. And watching it this time, yeah, I think you're onto something, Stuart. I usually don't like these films where, like, we're all connected, like Crash and all that, and Babel, and, you know, but I do think that is part of it. Like, how does a dirty cop getting put on suspension, like, affect society through these different avenues? And, you know, we'll see what the cop's reaction to this armed robbery is once this woman dies. So I think it does play a purpose, but if you just want a streamlined 100-minute film, because I think this could be a 100-minute film, then you're going to be frustrated by this. I get what you're saying, because the first time it totally caught me off guard. This time I was ready for it and really paying attention, trying to see what the director's intent was.
To be really clear, Henry has his younger brother in a wheelchair. Mel Gibson has a daughter that's going to be bullied that he believes, they stay in the neighborhood, he mentions she's going to get raped. There's that trauma here. And here is, again, another woman that, like, has a monologue about, my job is so stupid. I'm just moving paper around in numbers, and I don't even know what I'm selling to people. And what I'm doing it for is to be with a child that I can't actually be with. And that is the conflict all of these people are struggling with. I see thematically, they're all very well connected. I agree with you. If this were just a random shakeup, they're just characters living a life that wouldn't be very satisfying. I see thematic resonance throughout this movie. I see a lot of good plotting, even though it is open. It is messy in a certain regard.
And I just think that they're trying to make us feel something for nameless clerk that dies. Because in so many movies, you see a bank robbery, there's some teller, she gets shot in the face, and we know nothing about her.
It's also worth pointing out, this is Jennifer Carpenter, star of Dexter. I think people will recognize her and think she's going to be a big part, someone is going to be taken from this bank and being a hostage. Later, I'm like, did she live? Did she not get in the shot? Because that's her, right, in the back. It takes me a while to realize she's not the hostage.
Yeah, no, she clearly gets her, like, it's so gruesome. Like, first her, like, fingers get blown off, and then the way her head just caves in. Zoller loves caving in heads, like, when she gets her head shot. But I will say, what's also effective about having this little side journey, like, okay, here's this mom, this new mom that doesn't want to leave her baby, and she's forced to go to work, and no one's good at this point, right? Like, Henry, now he's complicit in this murder. Anthony, Brett, like, everyone's dirty at this point, and that's what Brett and Anthony will bemoan. Like, there's supposed to be no civilian casualties.
And to be clear, they could have stopped this by calling it in, but they didn't call it in because they want to make money off of this, and they're suspended. If they say, we know all about this, and they're doing cop work, they're in the hot seat. So they're choosing to protect themselves in order to profit from this, thus creating more chaos. It is on their moral conscience. And that is an interesting dilemma to see as they go along. They keep telling themselves, should we do this? Should we call it in? What's the ethical line? But the truth of the matter is, for Mel Gibson, I think he'll do anything in order to save his family. It seems to be Vince Vaughn that has more trouble and keeps pressing him, like, all right, I'm assembling this gun, but I'm not killing people just to rob them.
But he never gets out. He's like, I'm in until I'm out. He never gets out. They have all those conversations while they're waiting for the guy to show up at the non-existent apartment before the robbery. You know, the stakeout scenes, again, it made me think of Tarantino. We're going to have a lot of conversations. We're going to talk about the bread in a sandwich. And
yeah, I do want to say, like, with the dialogue during the stakeout, I say this is like Tarantino, but we're just going to make it grim and gritty. That's not to say Zoller doesn't write, like, funny stuff. Like, a single red ant could eat that sandwich quicker than you. Like, there are lines that I like and make me chuckle throughout this, but it's just not that snappy, witty dialogue that you would expect from Tarantino.
Yeah, and there is, again, there is the craft, novelistic is what I would call it, probably working better on the page than this ugly video, but the idea that they're creating personas, they're spraying on gay hair shit, quote, and fake glasses and putting on ball caps at the same time the other guys are putting on white face. Like, we've seen that they are suddenly, in order to infiltrate this bank, they're going to cover their black skin, lighten it, and play act as well. Again, it's drawing all kinds of parallels between cops and criminals, much like Heat does, in interesting ways. It makes me wonder where this is going to end up. But I probably should have known, yes, with Jennifer. I didn't expect them to kill Jennifer Carpenter, but I should have figured most of the people in this bank are dead meat here. And you can't do this, right? Like, if it's in a bank vault, that gold bullion is like, they got the numbers and all. Like,
usually it's a time lock, yeah.
You'll have to fence this really good in order to ever cash in on that. The fact that a character is going to buy a house with gold bullion, I mean, they'll know where you got this from.
Oh, yeah, I have real problems with the ending of this film. We'll get there, but
it took them 11 months.
Oh, bullshit.
I mean, yeah, you could just say magic washing of criminal laundry. But
yeah, the IRS would be up his ass with a microscope.
Yeah, agreed. We'll get there when we get there. I will go ahead and agree with you this much. I do feel like the ending of this movie disappoints me, but I, up to this point, sounds like you're not enjoying it. I'm actually surprised at how much more I'm enjoying this than Heat.
I was enjoying it at the beginning during the introductions, and while we had the mystery of who's the criminal, and who's this guy in the mask who's shooting up the store stupidly. But by the time we get to the bank robbery, we've had way too many diversions. We've spent too much time away from Henry, who I thought was the main character. We've spent so much time with Brett, Mel Gibson, and Anthony, Vince Vaughn, but not doing anything. But I'm hopeful. When we get to this bank robbery, I'm hopeful now things will pick up.
Just as far as the bank robbery goes, forget about this little side character that you're annoyed with her little journey. I like the mechanics of this bank robbery. That's one of the things I do like about Michael Mann, is like, things feel very thorough and thought out. And like, the fact that they got this tape recorder playing this voice, I don't know how practical it is, but it's got that sense of cool that I really dig and can get into at this point. Like, just seeing the mechanics go down.
It's funny to think about, they already know how it's going to go. Like, they're married to what's on the tape. They just know that there's going to be a woman there that is going to be the one to tie up everybody. Like, she will do. Like, that's what they say, but how would they know that Jennifer Carpenter's character is going to be there? It's just, it's funny to see this all come together. I don't know if it feels realistic or even Michael Mann-like, but I do like it. And I, again, I like this movie. I like the fact that the cops are across the street debating about how involved they should be, because again, they didn't plan on this. We thought we were robbing a drug deal gone bad. Now innocent people in the financial district of downtown. This is a town that is failing economically in all kinds of ways. This is the one area where things are doing well. Rich white people are dying. There's going to be heads rolling for this. And if it comes out that we knew something about it, we didn't do anything about it. Yeah, we'll never be cops again.
Can I give a shout out? There's one actor here. I've just seen him in a couple of things. I really like him. Fred Melamed. He's the bank manager.
I hate what he's doing in this.
Yeah, I don't like him in here. I love him in The Serious Man, but I don't understand like this grand entrance that he gives this character. It's so bizarre.
He's this new agey bank owner. I've never met a new agey bank owner. I didn't know that this was a thing. But unlike you, I liked the postpartum depressed woman coming back to work. That's something that I've observed in real life. And I felt like they were nailing something that was true and totally threw me a surprise, much like the scene in Pulp Fiction where the gun goes off and the back seat is covered with somebody's face. I just didn't think it was going to go this way. I don't know where it's going now that, Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn think they've got these guys boxed in, and then a sports car comes in and they get away. And so they have to just chase them out of town for hours and hours.
It feels like that, doesn't it? It feels like that goes on for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, I think that is kind of the intent of it. Again, we're going to find out, hey, when they pull over to get gas, we're just going to pull to the side of the road because we have gas cans in the back. Like, it feels novelesque, I think he said, Stuart, but that's the kind of movie this is, where it is more about spending time with the characters, and which kind of builds up the tension for the action that's going to happen. Like, we're going to get, I think, like a 30, 40 minute shootout at the end. And I'm tense. I'm wondering how things are going to play out when we get there.
And Henry and Brett, Mel Gibson, are starting to literally see each other now. I think it's interesting that Henry is in the front seat, knows they're being tailed, but decides not to tell their bosses in the back, because, hey, we might actually need dirty cops to help us, because I don't think we're going to live through this. So there is, again, I'm feeling that I'm pulled into their story more than Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn. I actually feel bad for these guys, even though they got into this by their own doing. Maybe I shouldn't. But again, they were just trying to do a job to help out a misfortunate brother and mother.
Now they're having to clean up this woman's piss and throw the papers out the window. Like, sour deal at this point.
For sure. And again, they planned for this. I like when they start talking about cellophane noodles. We know exactly what they mean.
Yep.
That was the insurance that they planned on. If this goes bad, we will still have guns, even though they think we put our guns in the glove box.
And just your opinion, these guys were dead meat, even if the cops hadn't come along, right? Because the guys in the masks are just psychopaths. They wouldn't want anyone, any accomplice. A, they don't want to split the money. And B, they wouldn't want anybody around who could possibly give any information of where they came from or where they went. As soon as they agreed to this job, they were dead.
Yes, exactly. I do believe they were expendable. That's why they were hired. And this was going to be, when we get to this desolate gas station that couldn't have had a pump working in the last 50 years, I definitely feel like this was going to be where they were going to get buried. They know it. That's why this turns quickly into a shootout. And Biscuit is the one that dies, but not before swallowing the van key.
I'm back into it a little bit at this point, just because I like the swallowing of the van key. And then he pukes and he grabs the key and swallows it again.
This does feel Tarantino. And then like he dies and they're like, okay, we got to cut him open. And usually in a movie, like you just cut it and pull the key out. But they're like, no, okay, let's see. It's this sack here. Now don't cut the liver or else we're going to get this bad smell. Like the amount of detail they go into just becomes funny to me.
And comfortable laughter too, because then they've always got to stick in. There's always the awareness of the other. There's always the sense the white people are like, well, don't cut into his liver. He's a black guy. We know what that is. There's this racism that just bubbles to the surface time and again. And almost every character will be guilty of this at some point. It makes you constantly aware of that being such a hard barrier between black and white. To see those as two completely separate entities is what they're trying to do, so that I think they can have the ultimate black-white buddy team-up when Mel Gibson gets together with Henry.
Yeah, one of my favorite language devices they use. Like, we'll have Henry and, like, I ain't this, I ain't that. And they're like, you mean you're not this? And he's like, you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And really, isn't that what matters? Like, you know what he means. Now you're just giving him a hard time because he's not using the same language as you. Like, I like just little things like that in this film to draw the other and to show that conflict and how people don't have to put on KKK robes to be racist. There are little things. It's like Get Out. There can be little things that tell that you see someone, and all races do this. I'm not saying, you know, only white people are guilty of this. Everyone does this, but I like how this movie plays that out. It's an awful thing to have to reflect on, but it's something that exists in society and that we should reflect on.
You know, we've talked about the dialogue in this movie and how it's somewhat Tarantino-ish, but I gotta say, I got 99% pissed off by all the percentages that Mel Gibson's character is spouting, pulling out of his ass. Like, what are the chances of survival? 80% for me, 60% for you. Where are these numbers coming from?
See, I thought that was funny. Yeah, because he's just making it up.
Yeah, I it seems to be, and I'm trying to hone in to why you like Mel Gibson. I think you like Vince Vaughn, but you don't seem to be connecting with these characters.
I like Vince Vaughn more than Mel Gibson, and I haven't really liked a Mel Gibson performance in 20 years. Here,
I mean, you like Lethal Weapon. That's what I'm really trying to say. I'm not trying to imply you condone what Mel Gibson might have said in his personal time. I'm saying these are actors that I have heard you champion in substandard movies sometimes, but here, what is the resistance, if you can identify
it? It's not the actors' performances. I think the actors are doing good jobs, and they're doing what is written for them. But what is written for them is what I'm not liking. It's because it feels very forced, it feels very unnatural, and it feels very long.
Okay, so it is both the fact that this movie, I agree, at this point, is dragging. Everyone knows I like slow boil, atmosphere, take some time for the character, don't be in such a hurry to tell me plot, plot, plot. But definitely by this point, and certainly where I know where they're going to, when I figure out that it's really about the criminal and the cop teaming up, I would have liked to have seen that happen much earlier than it does. It does feel, as we've hit the 2-hour mark here, and we're not even at the gas station, it's too long.
And what I felt, and it hit me as they're in this chase, right as they're parking, and I realize what's going to happen. I realize Vince Vaughn's dead meat, even though he was the more innocent one. I realize that probably everybody's going to die, as in so many Tarantino films. And that's what makes this movie unpleasant to me, is it's completely nihilistic, and it never has the levity to balance it. You can have a nihilism, but I think it needs to be packaged in a certain way so that it's not just bile. And here, this nihilism is just very unpleasant.
I mean, where were the laughs and Heat? I mean, I definitely feel like there's a lot of movies that are nihilistic. A lot of things from the 70s don't go near comedy. I mean, I think you could definitely have a vision of pitilessness that works. I mean, it just makes the movie super cold.
Yeah, I feel like this is kind of the most 2019. Well, Parasite's a very 2019 film as well, talking about the class struggle, but like, this is a very 2019 film speaking to what is going on at the time. And that's kind of why I go with this nihilism, because yeah, I kind of feel like, what do we do in this situation? Like, no one wants to listen to each other. No one wants to see things from different perspectives. And we're all hypocrites. Like, the thing with Mel Gibson is, like, I had to step on this guy's head because it got drugs out of schools, but then he's willing to let innocent people die because he needs money to retire on. Like, yeah, it is a nihilistic, dark, feel bad film. I also think it's appropriate for the times. It taps into it.
Yeah, I like moral ambiguity and challenge like this. So I'm not saying all of the situations are great. Could this use some tightening up? At this point, I certainly could, but I have called the surprise. So they finally cornered the van. They seem to have the edge here. The guys have the van key back. They make the hostage go out, get Biscuit, cut open them up. We can drive away from here, but these cops have us in their sights, and who knows where Henry is. They decide the way to handle the cops I thought one of the assassins in the black gloves or gray gloves was actually in drag. But then they've actually convinced the hostage, we're going to kill you if you don't kill them.
No, no, they're going to murder her family. Like, they take a picture of her license and send it to very bad men that will do awful things if she doesn't do what they say.
Yeah, it's a Saw kind of situation. And I appreciate that because I don't really like Saw movies, but here it works.
And I just feel that it's a stretch that the hostage would shoot a cop so ruthlessly and not just be like, hey, I'm with a cop. I'm safe now. And now they can get this guy and save my family.
No, there's no guarantee that they're going to stop these guys. They're dirty cops. They're not even supposed to be there.
Who would put money on Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn winning this fight?
Yeah.
Super van, super killers, those high-powered weapons. I definitely would be shooting Mel. I would not be thinking that he could save me.
I'm glad Mel shot her in the head because
jeez.
It's just, it pissed me off that this is how Vince Vaughn goes out, you know?
No, not just this. He also gets a phone call from his girlfriend.
But he listens to it after he's shot. And so he's like, well, in dying, I'll at least know she loved me. Nope, she turned me down.
Yeah, that is perfect for this film. And he kind of knows it, right? Like, that's a weird proposal. Is like, hey, go get this thing. I left something in my jacket. Can you go get it? Because she knows he's out doing something crooked. He's gone all hours of the day. Like, and he says she might be too smart for me. And ultimately she is. Like, she realizes he maybe not as bad as Mel Gibson's character, but he's willing to go along with it. He's willing to play that code of silence for the boys in blue and be an accomplice.
Yeah, and I feel like Mel Gibson's reaction here, it reminds me of actually what Kurt Russell does on the most memorable scene of Bone Tomahawk. He's trying to make this man that is literally being cut in half feel better by telling him a lie about a posse that's going to come and save the day. And here Mel Gibson's just like kicking the shit out of this phone. Like, that's going to make you feel better that I'm just beating your phone as you die. But it's, again, it's very dark comedy and it may not register as comedy, but I, without laughing, I appreciate the area that it's plumbing and how it feels different from Michael Mann and Tarantino. In many ways, it feels like a similar joke they would all make, but this feels particular to Zoller as a writer.
This is my first Zoller film. To me, it all just feels like a wannabe Tarantino. It just, it never escapes that shadow for me.
Oh, it feels so different, his intention. Yes, he's plumbing the same material, but he wants to do something different than Tarantino does. Tarantino wants to make it cool and hip and give us a good time and give us fairy tales to believe in that reshot Hitler and cleanly stopped Manson and all that. Zoller would be focusing on Manson just killing everyone. Manson would probably be more successful in a Zoller film.
Well, I'm thinking of classic Tarantino of the 90s period where, you know, Reservoir Dogs did not have a fairy tale ending and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but it had heroic characters. Like, he played into these archetypes of that. It almost plays as a samurai film to me with these ideas of honor. Like, that is in those films. This is not a film with honor. There is no honor in this one.
Yeah, I feel like it is trying to work more as a drama than Tarantino is ever comfortable completely laying out. I mean, again, a lot of this does feel similar to Hateful Eight. It does feel similar to the way that Walton Goggins is able to bury his racism in The Hatchet and work with Sam Jackson. I feel like that's what should happen here in the climax. And where I ding the writing of this movie, the only time I ding the writing of this movie is that I actually feel like what he and Henry does feels anticlimactic. I wanted a different, I'm not even saying a happy ending for them, but I wanted a different ending than what we get after Mel Gibson has largely laid waste to the people in the van on his own.
And I kind of wanted them to get on with it a little bit. There's a lot of Henry shooting the gun out of Mel Gibson's range. I mean, Henry, he supposedly went to prison for revenge against the guys who put his brother in a wheelchair. But man, that guy can shoot your pistol with a pistol at 20 yards. Where did he get that kind of sharpshooting ability? The fact that it's all so stupid from this point on that there's, what, $1 billion of gold right there, but Henry needs to have his 60%, and Mel Gibson's fine with 40% if he delete that damn video. And I'm sorry, but if you are in Mel Gibson's place, and you've killed so many people that night, and your friend is dead that night, and you can put a gun to somebody's neck, you pull that trigger.
Yeah, but if you're in Henry's place, you're a black man, you know what that means to society, you're an ex-con, you got a cop here, he might be a dirty cop, he's still a cop, he's gonna have pull. You want to keep that video. Like, I understand both sides. Like, I understand why Gibson doesn't want him to have the video. I understand why Henry wants to hold on to that video. That's his insurance policy. That is the thing. Like, everyone is right and wrong and has their viewpoints, and, like, it's not clean. It is messy.
But I think what Arnie's saying is that Mel Gibson should just be a little more ruthless and just shoot this guy rather than being saying, I don't want to kill you. But I guess he needs the password. That's the other part of it. Although he's an expert phone killer. He could just kill the phone with the video on it.
It might be uploaded to the cloud. Who knows?
But here's what I would say. If they had done something in this very long stretch of time that made me feel like Gibson was understanding Henry in a new way as something different than just another thug, another person that he arrests, if they had actually been able to see and recognize each other as fellow men, then I could buy, hey, I don't want to kill you. But yeah, I feel like a chunk of their story does not come to light in this crucial climax. And consequently, I just don't like anything that happens after Mel gets shot.
See, I see this as, yeah, this is the point that even when we could have almost unlimited wealth in practical terms, billions of dollars probably with this gold, we still can't make peace because we see each other as the other, and that is the failure. And that, I think, is the most moralizing this film might get. And even then, it doesn't put a big punctuation mark on it. It just, that's what plays out. I will agree, the ending has always seemed weird. The first time I saw it, I'm like, again, it was like when that woman shows up with the postpartum depression. I'm like, wait, what happened all of a sudden? Like, it feels like it's almost dreamlike, a fairy tale now.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. Again, I like that scene. I just feel like dramatically, these characters in a Tarantino movie, I mean, the reason why Bruce Willis is able to set aside that beef with Ving Rhames and work through that, that's what that second chapter is about. Something like that needed to transpire in killing the drug dealer and his two goons. Some team up needed to happen. You know what I mean? Like, they needed to put aside their differences to win that fight. And the fact is, it was mostly done by Mel, and Henry pops up after the fact. I'm fine with the Treasure of Sierra Madre ending. It can end bleak. It can end with the idea that we ultimately don't trust each other, and that's why someone is dead. But I just felt like, if it was about two different characters that were able to see a little bit about each other, there should have been a little bit more coming together before they broke apart.
I agree completely. I think that Henry needed to be a more active character in that fight. I lost count of the bodies, but I didn't even realize everybody in that van was dead when Henry was taunting Mel. The fact that Mel did all the killing and then Henry comes out from the shadows. Listen, and I get it. I don't think Zoller wants there to be any characters that we like in this movie. Well, mission accomplished, because Henry just skulks out from the shadows.
Guys. Mel is the lion and Henry is the safari hunter.
Oh, I got it at the end. Oh, believe me. The message mallet came right out at the end.
Yes.
Or at least the metaphor mallet. But the thing is, from the beginning of the movie, I still like Henry as a character. You know, even when he's like, you know, Mel Gibson's dying, he's like, give my wife 40%. Oh, she's not getting 40, but I'll take her. She'll be taken care of.
I like that, yeah. I don't know. It feels very real to me that this is about our ugly reality, and it feels that way.
It gets close. It really gets close to nailing and landing that ending, but I don't think it's the landing sticks. I think they stumble, and then the fact that it just goes on for 10 more minutes just makes me feel like, rewrite. You know what? You don't let it go on longer. You go back and change things so that it's better.
Yeah, I'd say that after Gibson dies and Henry buries the bodies and apologizes to Biscuit that he has to bury him with these other assholes, you go to the wife with multiple sclerosis opening the gold and credits roll. You don't have Henry in his hammer mansion, you know?
There are things that I like. Like, this ending's not totally off-putting to me. Like, again, it's when the novelist comes out, the writer Zoller comes out. You get Henry saying, oh, you want sushi? And the mom's like, no, I'm going to make home cooking. And then you cut over to Mel's family and the wife saying, oh, I hurt too much to make anything. Let's just go get Chinese. Like, I like those little reversals there that, to me, that's just telling. But yeah, if you want to get into the logistics of this ending, it's silly.
It's a little silly. I had a bigger problems with brawl than and its silliness than this movie. I feel like it's less silly than his second film. But yeah, I mean, I like the idea. What they were trying to get at is the fact that here was a guy who, by society's terms, by these cops' terms, he was a criminal, an ex-con, black, and we don't like him. And he was able to change his world. That his brother wanted to get into video games because he wanted to live in a different world. That's why he played video games and wanted to design them. And he, here at the end, playing that game again, he was literally able to change. He no longer lives in a housing project. He has manifested his dreams. That's kind of interesting, but again, did the landing stick? Does that feel true? Does that, I don't know. There's just something about this that feels like it's pushing too hard.
Yeah, I agree.
I had some serious problems with this film throughout, but honestly, at no point did I find the film unsalvageable, and a really good ending could have redeemed this movie for me.
Well, you said you red arrowed it when the woman got shot.
It could have been pulled out. It could have been pulled out. But that was the moment I was certain what I was seeing I do not like for the way it's the story is told. But if it had stuck a great landing, an ending is so important to a story. If it had had a great one, I might have changed my mind on it. But no, what they gave me just put a nail in the coffin. It didn't help save anything. The mansion bit was just... Suspension of disbelief is very important in a story. I have to believe that Keanu Reeves is a super hacker in the Matrix. I have to believe he knows how computers work. I have trouble with that, but I'm able to suspend disbelief. I can't suspend disbelief that Henry, minor criminal, was able to launder or fence all this gold and somehow make it look legitimate that he can buy this mansion, and his mother just gave up the heroin.
Does this 5 minutes ruin the film? I think it's already ruined for you, but
yeah,
it's 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think Arnie hasn't enjoyed what's happened before. What I feel is they haven't reached the ending that would be the most satisfying, but it does feel like it brings some ideas to a close. We had a character that everyone counted out that has changed his fortune and switched places. And so what does that mean? I don't know. Whatever you want it to.
Let's find out. Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Dragged Across Concrete? Jacob.
Yeah, I started saying that I saw this film early on in the year. It was in my top 10. It dropped down. Like, 2019 was a rough year for films, and some good ones finally came out towards the end of the year. But this is probably still in the top 15 for me, maybe. Top 20, definitely. The problem with Zoller is he never gets enough money. And it's not just so he can indulge and have even better CGI or whatever. It's just like, no, just give him a couple million more so he could, like, just polish it up to where it needs to be. So, yes, are there technical opportunities here? Definitely. But what I liked about this film, what drew me to it, even though it's long and it's going to just go through lots of arbitrary details to just build up this world and build up the methods of these characters, like, I enjoy it because of the dialogue it's having. It is a very dark, grim, ugly dialogue that we don't want to have. We want to believe that we could go on Twitter and go, this person is canceled, and now we've solved that racist person. They're gone. That's not how the real world works. This movie shows how difficult it is for the world to work, for us to get along, because we have biases. We have these ugly outlooks. We feel like we've been wrong for whatever reason, or, you know, people just want us to be PC or whatever. That's what I gravitate with this film, is that it takes this ugly reality and presents it as ugly as it is. It's not going to comment on it because it's a conversation we all need to have to figure this out. And maybe admitting that we all have ugly feelings is a starting point, maybe. But I like this film. It's tense. I like the mystery at the beginning. Why are these guys running around shooting up convenience stores and killing people in their cars? Like, this is a tense film that draws me in and keeps my attention for most of its almost 3-hour running period. Yes, it's not a perfect film. It's a very good film. It's definitely Zoller's best film. Strong recommend.
Stuart.
First, let's get out of the way. Zoller is a disciple of Tarantino and Michael Mann. And in some ways, I think he's a much better writer than Michael Mann. But yes, he is not equaling Tarantino. You might want to hold that against him. But I think there is more to encourage fans of those directors than discourage. It's good to know there are people that are still trying to make this movie 30 years after Reservoir Dogs, because I feel like in franchise films these days, stuff like this, the hard edges get sanded down, things get soft-pedaled, and here's a movie that happily runs into the fire and says, here's where we're really at. And I'm cynical cynical about it. I'm not going to put a happy end to it. I'm going to drag you across concrete. It's going to hurt like a motherfucker. I wish this film looked as good as a Michael Mann film. I am still wondering if Zoller isn't a better writer who might see his films better realized by a seasoned director taking it on. Like I said, I picked up one of his books. It was a police novel called Bad Business on North Ganson Street, and it's got a very similar story. There's a cop who's unfairly demoted. He moves his family to a shithole town where his daughter is being harassed, and he ends up partnering with a dirty cop that takes him on a bad mission. It feels like this, but it's so much better as a novel than this movie is as a visual experience. And so I do feel like some of it is maybe this is underfunded, and some of this is Zoller just has some gifts in writing that he does not have in directing. And I definitely feel like this pace is way too slow. Even if you like slow boil, man, this movie did need to be a whole lot shorter. But don't get me wrong. I think it's a very solid demonstration of a major talent who, with a little more experience, a little bit more money, will deliver a classic. I can feel it in my bones. Zoller is going to make a great film, but this isn't it. I'm just going to call it a recommend and hope for better things next time.
And you say Zoller's a disciple of Tarantino and Mann. There's a difference between a disciple and an imitator. And I do feel he's imitating, but trying to do his own artistic things with it. I mean, I can't decide if it's bullheadishness or balls to say I'm not going to put a score in a film. There's a reason that scores are in films. You know, it's because it helps heighten the mood. It helps convey mood. And so to not do that,
I mean, there's tons of films without score. Are you against all of them?
Yeah, and listen to what he's saying. What he's saying is, I want the actor to have that role, not some pop star.
No, but I'm talking score, not even music.
Well, whatever. I'm saying that he doesn't want the shorthand of a song that gets in your head and makes you fist pump to take away from what it should be an actor's job.
Okay, but a lot of this is the language of cinema. Having a score is part of that language. I think you have, you know, Jacob, you said, am I against every movie that doesn't have a score? Well, fuck no with generalizations, but I think you have to know the rules before you can break the rules. And I don't feel like Zoller has a mastery of cinema. I don't believe he's such a genius filmmaker that he's going to create new grammars of film. I believe he's going to come in here and try to do what he's seen done in a way that he finds more interesting.
I just want to understand. I'm not arguing. Do you feel like scores that there is decades of film with no sound? So I don't know. I don't see scores this. It's an important element. It could ruin a film. It could enhance a film. I don't think it's always needed, though. I don't see that as a big artistic dare to not have a score.
And I just also want to throw in, it's not a movie full of room tone. Like, there are songs that he has written that sound like old 70s slow jams, disco hits. They got known artists to do them. Tavares, you know, It Only Takes a Minute. Like, he had pop hits back in the day. OJs are a big band. Got LaVert in it. I mean, there's music here to enjoy. It's just he's not creating a soundtrack that will make you pay attention to the soundtrack over his character.
Right. And I mean, I'm not saying this is musicless. I'm saying he thinks he knows more about filmmaking than every filmmaker that's come before him.
I wouldn't presume that.
How do you say that? Yeah.
Certainly, I would encourage you to watch bonus material then, because he's very humble.
Okay, I just, when I see this kind of reckless abandon of the norms, I take that as arrogance. Even outside the arrogance, what I have here is an interesting setup. I really do find this interesting, but as you mentioned, a lot of it is heat, you know, to a degree. I mean, the cops are the criminals, but criminals robbing criminals.
You love Heat, too. To be clear, I remember you saying it was one of the best movies.
Yeah, I do. I absolutely love Heat. Heat has better acting. Just off the top, Kilmer, De Niro, Pacino.
I thought Pacino was bad in the film.
I know, but you think Pacino's bad in most things he's done after the 70s.
I thought Pacino was bad in that film, and I thought you guys agreed with me.
Yeah, I thought Pacino was bad. I think Heat's overrated. I like it, but I think it's overrated.
And I like the dynamic that's set up. I like the story that's set up. I like the plot put in motion of cops deciding to rob a criminal and they get in over their head. But the narrative flow is constantly disrupted in a way that never let me find a rhythm with this movie. And it's titled Dragged Across Concrete. I'd say I was dragged across the finish line for it. It's a not recommend.
Okay, so let me ask you this. an unpleasant first experience. Would you be interested in going back to Bone Tomahawk or seeing the next S. Craig Zahler film?
Bone Tomahawk, I've heard so much about that I'd be willing to give it a try. I'm never going to judge an entire person based off one film.
I think it is still his best film. I'll just go ahead and put that out there. Jacob is saying this is the best one. For me, I think Bone Tomahawk.
That one just felt like it was really hurt by the lack of money. Like, I'm like, oh, it feels like a stage play at times. Like, it's so sparse.
Yes, it really, I'm not denying that. But I'm interested. Again, my hope is that if, you know, you water the seed long enough, eventually it will bloom. We don't have a great film from him yet, but I see greatness in there somewhere. What's he going to do next? Well, we know that he's got a new novel coming this summer. And I do encourage people to read him, even if you're uncertain about the films. He's so much better on the page.
Yeah, I had no idea he was a writer. I'm looking forward to reading some of his stuff now.
Yeah, he's got sci-fi, too. I mean, he's got different genres, that even not just Westerns. This new one sounds like it's some kind of high-tech pimp scenario. It's called The Slanted Gutter. And it's about a dot-com geek that runs gambling dens and bordellos and meets his match with the stripper. I don't know what that means, but could go anyway. I trust him and I trust his ability to craft characters. I think it could be good. As far as his next movie project, I do know that his last novel got optioned by Vince Vaughn. And boy, this title, I dare them to put out a movie with this title. Hug Chicken Pea, the Panegyric? I don't even know that's a word.
Stuart, are you having a stroke? You're just saying random things right now.
The Panegyric of an Anomalous Child. What the hell is that? It sounds like a cross between Charles Dickens, Oliver Twist, and Eraserhead. It is about a deformed orphan who is adopted by a scientist.
This is what Vince Vaughn has optioned?
Apparently so. And again, the book got good reviews. I trust him as a writer. But again, I'm not sure that's cinematic, or maybe it's very cinematic in somebody else's hands. I don't know that Zahler is going to make that. I know that it's been optioned. I also know that book that I read I really liked has been optioned. They want Jamie Foxx and Leonardo DiCaprio to do it. Perfect. Make that movie. I hope it works. But yeah, we don't have a next film for Zahler on the docket, but we do have a next film for donors. We do know what we're doing in April.
It's another patron pick, a big summer Spielberg film.
Yeah, almost 20 years old. 19 years ago, Spielberg wanted to honor Stanley Kubrick, recently passed away, loved him as a filmmaker and his friend. So he agreed to do a project Kubrick always said he wanted to do, but never got around to. AI, artificial intelligence. And boy, it does feel like half a Spielberg movie and half a Kubrick movie. It's a really strange marriage.
Yeah, I have flash memories of my seeing it one time opening weekend in theaters. I'm really looking forward to revisiting it. I honestly don't remember if I would have recommended it or not back then. I think I was pretty midline.
I had all kinds of feelings. They were hot and cold. And you know what? It is always healthy to go back and see a film that challenges you and to see where it settles. And does it settle at the bottom or does the cream rise to the top? We'll find out.
Will you like the cute robot teddy bear? Or will you like the cute robot Jude Law prostitute?
Yep. And in between, we're going to finally get to summer donation. Yep, we're gearing that back up. And that means we're hitting silver level with Us. And after that, Quiet Place 1, 2, and Bird Box. That's platinum level.
Well, I hope you'll join us when we review that next week. So thank you to all the patrons for listening to this. Thank you to Sean Ray for picking another movie for us, and there's still a couple more Sean Ray has in the kitty that we will be getting to. So until next time, anchovies!
You fucking dumbass. I wasn't gonna blackmail you, my word's good. Should've trusted a nigga. All I ever did for this was steal some autos, peddle some blow, and put the fool who crippled my brother into intensive. I've never killed nobody.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Do not prioritize money over having a heartbeat. Do you understand that?
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
We don't do what we do just for the paycheck.
And we want to wish a special thank you to Sean Ray for his tremendous support of our show and for picking Dragged Across Concrete for this patron-exclusive review.
You still in? I am until I'm not.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Gotta be aware of this stuff. Digital eyes are everywhere.
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
Think they know we're following?
30%.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
He scored very high in his tests.
I thought he had potential.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
If our associate does not return, we will execute this woman.
Now Playing is edited by Steven and Arnie.
Move like you and fast forward.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
He's got a mouth with his own engine, but he's solid.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I do what I think best when I'm out there.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
I didn't understand that, did you?
No. Sounded kind of like dolphin.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
Your ass went to jail. I did what I had to do.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
You said you weren't going to kill anyone unless it was in self-defense. You gave us your word.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
I'll handle this.
How?
There's a way. But it's not something we're going to talk about ever.
The reason why Bruce Willis decides to work it out with Vin Diesel. Arby's. He's got the meats.
Marcellus Wallace.
Yes.
I know, but what's his...
What's the actor's...
Ving Rhames.
There we go. All right. That's it. Yes, there we go. I dare them to put out a movie with this title.
Is it worse than the Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation? Like, a title so bad they have now changed it. I don't know if you heard this. It's now just Harley Quinn, : Birds of Prey.
They only changed it so that it would do better in search algorithms on ticket sites. They've come out and said that, no, the Fantabulous Emancipation is the title.
Oh, is that why? Okay.
Here's the title.